The Marching Season, Disc 8.
33. Amsterdam. The forecast for the Dutch coast was decent for March, so Delaroche mounted his Italian road bike early that morning and pedaled south. He wore long black cycling breeches and a white cotton turtleneck beneath his bright yellow jersey, tight enough to avoid flapping in the wind, loose enough to conceal the Beretta automatic beneath his left armpit. He headed south toward Leiden through the Bloembollenstreek, the largest flower-producing region in Holland, his powerful legs pumping effortlessly through fields already ablaze with color. For a time his eyes took in the Dutch countryside, the dikes and the canals, the windmills and the fields of flowers. But after a while the face of Maurice Leroux appeared in his thoughts. He had come to Delaroche in a dream the previous night, standing before him, white as a snowdrift, two holes in his chest, still wearing the foolish beret. "I can be trusted. I've done many men like you." Delaroche entered Leiden and had lunch at an outdoor café on the edge of the Rhine. Here, just a few miles from its mouth on the North Sea, the river was narrow and slow-moving, quite unlike the mountain whitewater near its birthplace high in the Alps or the wide industrial giant of the German plain. Delaroche ordered coffee and a sandwich of ham and cheese. The inability to purge his subconscious of Leroux's image unnerved him. Usually he suffered only a brief period of uneasiness after a killing. But it had been a week since he had killed Leroux, and he still saw his face floating through his mind. He thought of the man called Vladimir. Delaroche had been taken from his mother at birth and given to the KGB to raise. Vladimir had been his entire world. He had trained him in languages and tradecraft. He had tried to teach him something about life before teaching him how to kill. Vladimir had warned him that it would happen eventually. "One day you will take a life and that man will follow you," Vladimir had said. "He will take his meals with you, share your bed. When that happens, it is time for you to leave the trade, because a man who sees ghosts can no longer behave like a professional." Delaroche paid his bill and left the café. The weather worsened as he moved toward the North Sea. The sky grew overcast and the air turned colder. He fought a stiff headwind all the way to Haarlem. Perhaps Vladimir had been right. Perhaps it was time for him to get out of the game before the game caught up with him. He could move back to the Mediterranean, and he could spend days riding his bicycles and painting his paintings and drinking his wine on his terrace overlooking the sea, and to hell with Vladimir, and to hell with his father, and to hell with the director and everyone else who had forced this life on him. Perhaps he could find a woman like Astrid Vogel, a woman with enough dangerous secrets of her own that she could be trusted with his. He had wanted to leave the business once before. He and Astrid had planned to retire in hiding together, but with Astrid gone there hadn't been much point, and the director had made him a generous offer that was too good to turn down. He did not kill for the society out of conviction, though. He worked for the director because he paid him a tremendous amount of money and because he provided Delaroche protection from his enemies. If he left the society, Delaroche would be on his own. He would have to see to his own security or find a new guardian. He entered Haarlem and crossed the river Sparna. Amsterdam was 15 miles away, a good ride along the banks of the Noordzee Canal. The wind was at Delaroche's back, the road smooth and flat, so it took him little more than a half hour to reach the city. He took his time making his way to the Herengracht. He entered his flat and checked his telltales to make certain no one had been there in his absence. There was another hastily scrawled note from the German girl. "I want to see you again, you cocksucker. Eva." He switched on his computer and logged on to the Internet. He had one email message. He opened it and typed in his code name. The message was from the director. He wanted to meet Delaroche the following day in Amsterdam in the Vondelpark. Delaroche sent back a message saying he would be there. The following morning, Delaroche meandered through the stalls of the Albert Kaipmarkt in the Eastern Canal Ring. He meticulously checked his tail as he strolled past baskets laden with fruit, fish from the North Sea, Dutch cheeses, and freshly cut flowers. Satisfied he wasn't being followed, he walked from the market to the Vondelpark, the sprawling public gardens near Amsterdam's museum quarter. He spotted the director seated on a park bench overlooking a duck pond, the tall Jamaican girl next to him. The director had not seen Delaroche since the plastic surgery in Athens. Delaroche did not enjoy games or other amusements. The isolation and secrecy of his life had robbed him of any opportunity to develop a true sense of humor. But he decided to play a prank, to test the effectiveness of Maurice Leroux's work on his face. He placed a cigarette into his mouth and put on his sunglasses. He approached the director and, speaking in Dutch, asked him for a light. The director handed Delaroche a heavy silver lighter. Delaroche lit the cigarette and handed the lighter back to the director.
"Danke," Delaroche said.
The director nodded distantly as he placed his lighter back in his coat pocket. Delaroche walked away along the footpath. He returned a few moments later and sat next to the director, eating a pear he had purchased in the Albert Kaipmarkt, saying nothing. The director and the girl walked away and sat down on another bench. Delaroche eyed them curiously for a moment. Then he stood too and joined them on the next bench. The director frowned.
"I say, do you mind? I believe you wanted to see me," Delaroche said, removing his sunglasses. "Dear God," the director murmured, "is that really you?"
"I'm afraid so."
"You're quite hideous. No wonder you killed the poor bastard." "I have a contract for you."
The director's eyes flickered back and forth as the two men moved in tandem along the footpath through the Vondelpark. He had started as a field man. He had parachuted into France with the SOE during the war and run agents in Berlin against the Russians, and his survival instincts were still sharp.
"Have you been following the situation in Northern Ireland?" the director asked.
"I read the newspapers."
"Then you know that a Protestant terrorist group called the Ulster Freedom Brigade tried and failed to murder the American ambassador to the Court of St. James's, Douglas Cannon."
Delaroche nodded. "I read about it, yes."
"What you don't know is that the assassination team walked straight into a trap engineered by MI5 and the CIA. The CIA officer in charge of the American end of things was an old friend of yours."
Delaroche glared at the director.
"Osborne?"
The director nodded.
"Needless to say, the Ulster Freedom Brigade would like the ambassador and his son-in-law both dead, and we've agreed to do the job for them."
"To what end?"
"The brigade would like to destroy the peace process, and frankly, so would we. It's bad for business. In less than 2 weeks' time, on St. Patrick's Day, President Beckwith is holding a meeting of Northern Irish leaders at the White House. Douglas Cannon will be there."
"You know this for certain?"
"I have an impeccable source. The Americans are good at protecting their ambassadors abroad, but at home it's quite another story. Cannon will be lightly guarded, if at all. A professional of your skill should have no difficulty fulfilling the terms of the contract."
"Do I have a choice?"
"Let me remind you that I pay you a tremendous amount of money and provide protection for you," the director said coldly. "In return, you kill for me. It's a simple arrangement."
Delaroche knew the director would use whatever means at his disposal to achieve his ends.
"Actually, I would have thought you'd be thrilled at the opportunity to engage your old enemy," the director said.
"Why would you assume that?"
"Because of Astrid Vogel. I'm astonished that you haven't killed Osborne on your own already."
"I didn't kill him because I wasn't hired to kill him," Delaroche said. "I'm an assassin, not a murderer."
"Some people might see that as a distinction without a difference, but I understand your point and I respect you for it. However, Osborne continues to be a serious threat to your security. I'd sleep better if he were no longer with us."
Delaroche stopped walking and turned to face the director. 2 weeks is not much time, especially for a job in the United States."
"It's certainly enough time for you."
Delaroche nodded. I'll do it. Brilliant, the director said. Now that you've agreed to take on the contract, there's a catch. I'd like you to work with a partner. I don't work with people I don't know. I understand, but I'm asking you to make an exception in this case. Who is he? She, actually. Her name is Rebecca Wells. She's the woman who survived the Ulster Freedom Brigade's attempt to assassinate Douglas Cannon in England. She's an amateur, Delaroche said. She's a seasoned operative, and she's been blooded. For political reasons, we believe it's important for her to take part in the operation. I'm sure you'll enjoy the opportunity to work with her. And if I refuse? Then I'm afraid you'll forfeit your salary and the protection I provide you. Where is she? The director pointed down the gravel footpath. Walk that way, about 100 yards. You'll find her seated on a bench, blonde hair, reading a copy of Die Welt. I'll begin preparing the dossiers and arranging your transport to America. Remain here in Amsterdam until I contact you. And with that, the director turned and melted into the fog drifting over the Vondelpark. Delaroche purchased a small map of central Amsterdam from a tourist booth in the park. He sat down on the bench next to the one where Rebecca Wells was dutifully pretending to read the previous day's edition of Die Welt. He was less interested in the woman than in what was going on around her. For 20 minutes he scanned faces, looking for signs of physical surveillance. She appeared to be alone, but he wanted to make certain. He circled a spot on the map and walked over to her. Meet me here in exactly 2 hours, he said, handing her the folded map. Keep moving and don't arrive a minute early. The spot Delaroche had circled on the map was the National Monument in Dom Square. Rebecca Wells remained in the Vondelpark for more than a half hour, wandering through the gardens and past the winding lakes. Once she doubled back expertly and forced Delaroche to lunge into a public toilet for cover. From the park she walked to the Van Gogh Museum. She purchased a pass from the ticket window at the main entrance and went in. Delaroche followed her easily through the crowded museum. Van Gogh had been one of his earliest influences. He became distracted by one of his favorite works, Crows in the Wheatfield, and lost track of her. He found her a moment later, lingering before the bedroom at Arles. Something about the colorful canvas, Van Gogh's celebration of domestic peace, seemed to intrigue her. She left the museum, wandered through the Albert Kuipmarkt, and walked along the Sinkhole until she reached the Amstel River. There she jumped suddenly onto a passing tram. Delaroche flagged down a taxi and followed her. She took the tram to the Leitzeplein and walked to an outdoor café near the American Hotel, where she had coffee and a pastry. Delaroche watched her from a café on the other side of the canal. She paid her bill and stood up, but instead of walking away along the sidewalk, she ducked inside the café. Delaroche quickly crossed the canal. In Dutch, he asked the waiter if he had seen his girlfriend, an Irish woman, bleached blonde. The waiter nodded toward the toilet. Delaroche knocked on the door. There was no answer, so he opened it. The woman was gone. He peered through the kitchen and saw that there was a service entrance giving onto a narrow alley. He walked through the kitchen, ignoring the protests of the chefs, and entered the alley. There was no sign of her. He took a tram to Dom Square and found her seated next to one of the lions at the foot of the National Monument. She looked at her watch and smiled. "Where have you been?" she said. "I was worried about you." "You're not being followed," Delaroche said, sitting down next to her, "but you move like an amateur." "I lost you, didn't I?" "I'm one man on foot. Anyone can lose one man on foot." "Listen to me, you bastard. I'm from Portadown, Northern Ireland. Don't fuck with me. I'm cold, I'm tired, and I've had enough of this shit. The old man said you'd give me a place to stay. Let's go." They walked in silence along the Prinsengracht until they reached the Christa. Delaroche hopped down onto the aft deck and held out his hand for Rebecca to follow. She remained on the sidewalk, staring at him as if he were mad. "If you think I'm going to live on a fucking barge..." "It's not a barge," he said. "Take my hand, I'll show you." She boarded the houseboat without his help, and watched him open the padlock on the hatch over the companionway. She followed him down into the salon and looked around at the comfortable furnishings.
"Is this your boat?"
she asked. "It belongs to a friend of mine." She tried the switch on one of the lamps, but nothing happened. Delaroche went back onto the deck, removed the boat's power cable, and plugged it into a public outlet on the sidewalk. An instant later, Krista's salon burned with warm light. "Do you have any money?" Delaroche asked as he came back down the companionway.
"The old man gave me some," she said. "Who is he, by the way?"
"He's called the director."
"The director of what?"
"The director of the organization that is helping you kill the ambassador."
"What's it called?"
Delaroche remained silent.
"You don't know what it's called?"
"I know," he said.
"Do you know who belongs to it?"
"I've made it my business to find out."
She walked through the salon and sat down on the edge of Astrid's bed.
Delaroche switched on the small heater.
"Do you have a name?"
she asked. "Sometimes," he said.
"What should I call you?"
"You can stay here until we leave for America," Delaroche said, ignoring her question. "You'll need clean clothes and food. I'll bring some things for you later this afternoon. Do you smoke?" She nodded. Delaroche tossed her a packet of cigarettes. "I'll bring you more."
"Thank you."
"Do you have any other languages?"
"No,"
she said. Delaroche exhaled sharply and shook his head.
"I didn't need other languages to operate in Northern Ireland."
"This isn't Northern Ireland," he said. "Can you do anything about that accent?"
"What's wrong with my accent?"
"You might as well hang an orange sash across your chest."
"I can speak like an Englishwoman."
"Please do," he said. And with that he pounded up the companionway and closed the hatch behind him. 34. CIA Headquarters, Washington. 1 week after the director's meeting with Delaroche in Amsterdam, Michael Osborne returned to the Counterterrorism Center for the first time since leaving London. He punched in his code at the secure door and stepped inside. Carter was sitting at his desk, hunched over a stack of memos, clearly irritated. He looked up at Michael and frowned.
"Well, well, Sir Michael has decided to grace us with his presence," Carter said.
"It's an honorary knighthood. Your Majesty will do just fine." Carter smiled.
"Welcome home. We missed you. Everything all right?"
"Couldn't be better."
"You have 10 minutes to get read in. Then I need to see you and Cynthia in my office."
"Fine. I'll see you in half an hour."
Michael walked down Abu Nidal Boulevard to his cubicle. One of the center's wits had hung a large Union Jack over the cubicle wall, and "God Save the Queen" issued softly from a small tape player.
"Very funny," Michael called out to no one in particular. Blaze and Eurotrash appeared, followed by Cynthia Martin and Gigabyte.
"We just wanted to dress the place up a little bit for you, Sir Michael," Blaze said. "You know, make it feel a little less like Langley and a little more like home."
"That was very thoughtful of you."
Blaze, Eurotrash, and Gigabyte drifted away, singing a throaty rendition of "He Is an Englishman." Cynthia remained behind and sat down in the chair facing Michael's desk.
"Congratulations, Michael. You pulled off quite a coup."
"Thank you. I appreciate that."
"Secretly, I think I was hoping you'd fall flat on your face. Nothing personal, you understand."
"At least that's honest."
"Honesty has always been something of an affliction with me."
Michael smiled. "My father-in-law is coming to Washington in a couple of days, before the White House conference on Northern Ireland starts. He wants to spend some time with his grandchildren and see some old friends on the Hill. We're having a small dinner party the night before the conference. Why don't you join us? I know Douglas would value your opinion."
"I'd love to."
Michael scribbled his address on a slip of paper and handed it to her.
7 o'clock, he said.
"I'll be there,"
Cynthia said, folding the paper. "See you in Carter's office."
Michael sat down, switched on his computer, and read the overnight cables. An RUC patrol had discovered a car filled with 200 pounds of Semtex in County Antrim outside Belfast. A Republican splinter group called the Real IRA was thought to be responsible.
Michael closed the cable and opened another. A Catholic man had been shot to death near Banbridge in County Down. The RUC suspected that the Loyalist Volunteer Force, an ultra-violent Protestant extremist group, was responsible. Michael opened the next cable. The Portadown Lodge of the Orange Order had filed the proposed route for its annual parade. Once again, it was demanding the right to march along the Garvahee Road. This summer's marching season promised to be as confrontational as the last. He logged off the computer and walked into Carter's office. Cynthia was already there. "I hope you two don't plan on having a life for the next 48 hours," Carter said. "Our life is the agency, Adrian," Michael said. "I just got off the phone with Bill Bristol." "Are we supposed to be impressed because you spoke with the President's National Security Advisor?" "Would you shut the fuck up for 1 minute and let me finish?" Cynthia Martin smiled and looked down at her notebook. Carter said, "Beckwith has a bug up his ass about the Northern Ireland conference. It seems his poll numbers are down, and he wants to use the peace process to shore up his approval rating." "Isn't that nice?" Michael said. "How can we be of service?" "By making sure he's fully prepared for the conference. He needs a complete picture of the situation on the ground in Ulster. He needs background and intelligence to know how far he can push the Loyalists and the Nationalists to move things along. He needs to know whether we think a presidential trip to Northern Ireland is a good idea, given the climate." "When?" Michael asked. "You and Cynthia are briefing Bristol at the White House the day after tomorrow." "Oh, good. I thought it was going to be something unreasonable." "If you two don't think you can handle it, we can handle it." "I thought so." Michael and Cynthia stood up. Carter said, "Hold on a minute, Michael." "You guys want to talk about me behind my back?" Cynthia asked. "How'd you guess?" Adrian said. Cynthia scowled at Carter and went out. Carter said, "Don't make any plans for lunch." The CIA dining room is on the 7th floor, behind a heavy metal door that looks as though it might lead to the boiler room. It used to be called the Executive Dining Room until personnel discovered that the junior staff found the name offensive. The agency got rid of the word executive and opened the restaurant to all employees. Technically, workers from the loading dock could come to the 7th floor and eat lunch with deputy directors and division chiefs. Still, most staff preferred the massive basement cafeteria, affectionately known as the Swill Pit, where they could gossip without fear of being overheard by superiors. Monica Tyler sat at a table next to the window overlooking the thick trees along the Potomac. Her two ever-present factotums, known derisively as Tweedledum and Tweedledee, sat next to her, each clutching a leather folder as though they contained lost secrets of the ancient world. The tables around them were empty. Monica Tyler had a way of creating vacant space around herself, rather like a psychopath with a fistful of dynamite. Monica remained seated as Michael and Carter entered the room and sat down. A waitress brought menus and order cards. Guests in the dining room did not give their orders verbally. Instead, they had to meticulously fill out a small form and total their own bill. The agency wits joked that the forms were collected at the end of each day and sent to personnel for psychological evaluation. Carter sought vainly to engage Monica in small talk while he struggled with the complex order form. Michael knew the meal would be billed to the director's office, so he selected the most expensive items on the menu: shrimp cocktail, boiled crab cakes, and creme brulee for dessert. Tweedledee filled out Monica's form for her. "Now that you've managed to neutralize the Ulster Freedom Brigade," Monica began suddenly, "we think it's time that you leave the Northern Ireland Task Force and move on to something more productive." Michael looked at Carter, who shrugged. "Who's we?" Michael asked. Monica looked up from her salad as though she found the question impertinent. "The 7th floor, of course." "Actually, I was hoping I could spend more time working on the October case," Michael said. "Actually, I intend to remove you from the October case altogether." Michael pushed away his plate of half-eaten shrimp and laid his napkin on the table. "Part of our agreement about my return to the agency was that I would be allowed to spend part of my time searching for him. Why are you trying to back out of our agreement?"
To be honest with you, Michael, Adrian thought that allowing you to pursue October might be enough to entice you back to the center. But I never thought much of the idea, and I still don't. Once again, you've proven yourself to be an effective officer, and I would be derelict if I permitted you to continue to work on a case that is unlikely to bear fruit.
But it has borne fruit, Monica. I've proven October is still alive and still working as an assassin and terrorist.
No, Michael, you didn't prove he's alive. You theorize that he is still alive based on an enhancement of a photograph of a hand. That is quite a long way from ironclad proof.
We rarely deal with ironclad proof in this business, Monica.
Don't lecture me, Michael.
They fell silent as the waitress appeared and cleared away the first course.
We've sent an alert to Interpol, Monica resumed. We've given warnings to our allies. There is little else that can be done. At this point, it is a law enforcement matter, and this is not a law enforcement agency.
I disagree, Michael said.
On which point?
You know which point.
Monica's acolytes stirred in their seats restlessly. Carter picked at a loose thread in the tablecloth. Nothing infuriated Monica Tyler more than being challenged by someone below her on the agency food chain.
Someone hired October to assassinate Ahmed Hussein, Michael said. Someone is providing him with protection, travel documents, money. We need to find out who's sponsoring him. That's intelligence work, Monica, not law enforcement.
Once again, Michael, you're assuming October was the man in Cairo. It could have been an Israeli intelligence officer. It could have been a rival member of Hamas. It could have been a PLO assassin.
It could have been a Peking duck, but it wasn't. It was October.
I disagree.
She smiled to demonstrate that she had borrowed Michael's words intentionally. Her eyes flickered about him, as if searching for the best place to insert her dagger.
Michael yielded. What do you have in mind for me?
The Middle East peace process is on life support, she said. Hamas is planting bombs in Jerusalem, and we've received indications the Sword of Gaza is about to go operational in Europe. In all likelihood, that means they will target Americans. I want you to finish the preparations for the White House conference on Northern Ireland, and then I want you back on the Sword of Gaza.
What if I'm not interested?
Then I'm afraid your return to the Central Intelligence Agency, though highly successful, will be rather brief.
Morton Dunn was to the agency as Q was to Bond's Secret Service. The deputy chief of the Office of Technical Services, Dunn was the maker of exploding pens and high-frequency microphone transmitters that could be hidden in a belt buckle. He was an MIT-trained electrical engineer who could have earned 5 times his government salary in the private sector. He chose the agency because the paraphernalia of espionage had always intrigued him. In his spare time, he maintained the antique spy cameras and weapons housed in the agency's makeshift museum. He was also one of the world's top designers of experimental kites. On weekends, he could be found on the Ellipse, flying his creations around the Washington Monument. Once, he placed a high-resolution miniature camera aboard a kite and photographed every square inch of the White House South Lawn.
"You have authorization for this, I assume," Dunn said, seated in front of a large computer monitor.
He was prototypical MIT, thin, pale as a cave dweller, with wire-rimmed glasses that were forever slipping down the bridge of his narrow nose.
"I can't do this without authorization from your chief."
"I'll bring you the chit later this afternoon, but I need the photos now." Dunn laid his hands on the keyboard.
"What was his name?"
"October. The one we did last month for the Interpol alert."
"Oh, yeah, I remember," Dunn said, his fingers rattling over the keyboard.
A moment later, the face of October appeared on the screen.
"What do you want me to do?"
"I think he may have undergone plastic surgery to change his face," Michael said. "I'm almost certain the work was done by a Frenchman named Maurice Leroux."
"Dr. Leroux could have done any number of things to alter his appearance."
"Can you show me a few?" Michael asked. "Can you give me a complete series, change the hair, give him a beard, the works?"
"It's going to take a while."
"I'll wait."
"Sit over there," Dunn said. "And for God's sake, Osborne, don't touch anything."
It was just after midnight when Monica Tyler's chauffeured town car arrived at the Harbor Place complex on the waterfront in Georgetown. Her bodyguard opened the door and shadowed her through the lobby into the elevator. He walked her to the door of her apartment and remained there as she went inside. She ran water in her oversized bath and undressed. It was nearly morning in London. The director was a notorious early riser. She knew he would be at his desk in a few minutes. She slipped into the bath and relaxed in the warm water. When she was finished, she wrapped herself in a thick white robe. She went into the living room and sat down behind the mahogany desk. There were three telephones, an 8-line standard phone, an internal phone for Langley, and a special secure phone that permitted her to conduct conversations without fear of eavesdroppers. She looked at the antique gold desk clock, a gift from her old firm on Wall Street. 12:45 a.m. Monica thought of the circumstances, the coincidences, political alliances, and serendipity that had brought her to the top of the Central Intelligence Agency. She had graduated second in her class at Yale Law, but instead of heading off to a big firm, she added an MBA from Harvard to a resume and went to Wall Street to make money. There she met Ronald Clark, a Republican fundraiser and wise man who drifted in and out of Washington each time the Republicans controlled the White House. Monica followed Clark to Treasury, Commerce, State, and Defense. When President Beckworth appointed Clark to be Director of Central Intelligence, Monica became the Executive Director, the second most powerful position in the CIA. When Clark decided to retire, Monica lobbied for the top job, and Beckwith gave it to her. Ronald Clark left her a CIA in disarray. A series of other spy cases, including the Aldrich Ames case, had devastated morale. The agency had failed to predict either that India and Pakistan were about to explode nuclear devices or that Iran and North Korea were about to test ballistic missiles capable of hitting their neighbors. During her confirmation hearing, several senators pressed her to justify the size and cost of the Central Intelligence Agency. One wondered aloud whether the United States really needed a CIA now that the Cold War was over. She was supposed to be a mere caretaker, someone to keep the chair in the DCI's office warm for a couple of years, until Beckwith's successor could appoint his intelligence chief. But she was incapable of playing the role of caretaker, and set out on a mission to make herself indispensable to whoever sat in the Oval Office after Beckwith, Republican or Democrat. She believed she was the only person at Langley with the vision to lead the agency through the uncertain terrain of the post-Cold War period. She had studied the history of intelligence well. She knew that sometimes it was necessary to sacrifice a few in order to ensure the survival of the many. She felt a kinship with the deception officers of World War II, who sent men and women to their death in order to deceive Nazi Germany. She would never permit the agency to be castrated. She would never allow the United States to be without an adequate intelligence service. And she would do anything to make certain she was the one who was running it. Which is why she had joined the society, and why she abided by its code. At 1 a.m., she picked up the receiver on the secure telephone and dialed. A few seconds later, she heard the pleasant, cultured voice of the director's assistant, Daphne. Then the director came on the line. "You no longer need to worry about Osborne," she said. "He's been reassigned, and the October case file has been effectively closed. As far as the CIA is concerned, October is dead and buried." "Well done," the director said. "Where's the package now?" "Bound for the Caribbean," he said. "It should be arriving in the States sometime in the next 36 to 48 hours, and then it will be all over."
"Excellent," she said.
"I trust you will pass along any information that might help the package arrive at its destination on time."
"Of course, Director."
"I knew I could count on you. Good morning, Picasso," the director said, and the line went dead.
Chapter 35. Chesapeake Bay, Maryland. The Boston whaler bounced over the choppy waters of the Chesapeake. The night was clear and bitterly cold. A bright three-quarter moon floated high above the eastern horizon. Delaroche had doused the running lights shortly after entering the mouth of the bay. He reached forward and pressed a button on the dash-mounted navigation unit. The GPS system automatically calculated his precise longitude and latitude. They were in the center of the busy shipping lanes of the Chesapeake Channel. Rebecca Wells stood next to him, clutching the wheel of the whaler's second console. Without speaking, she pointed over the prow. Ahead of them, perhaps a mile away, shone the lights of a container vessel. Delaroche turned a few degrees to port and sped toward the shallow waters of the western shore. Delaroche had meticulously plotted his course up the Chesapeake during the long ride from Nassau to the east coast. They had made that leg of the journey aboard a large, ocean-going yacht piloted by a pair of former SAS men from the Society. He and Rebecca stayed in adjoining staterooms. By day, they studied NOAA charts of the Chesapeake, reviewed the dossiers of Michael Osborne and Douglas Cannon, and memorized the streets of Washington. At night, they went on to the aft deck and took target practice with Delaroche's Berettas. Rebecca pressed him for his name, but each time she asked, Delaroche simply shook his head and changed the subject. Out of frustration, she christened him Pierre, which Delaroche detested. On the last night aboard the yacht, he admitted that he had no real name, but if she felt it necessary to refer to him by something, he should be called Jean-Paul. Delaroche still was furious about being forced to work with the woman, but the director had been right about one thing. She was no amateur. The conflict in Northern Ireland had sharpened her skills to a fine edge. She had a superb memory and sound operational instincts. She was tall and quite strong for a woman, and after 3 nights of training with the Beretta, she was a more than adequate shot. Delaroche was concerned with only one thing, her idealism. He believed in nothing but his art. Zealots unnerved him. Astrid Vogel had been a believer like Rebecca once, when she was a member of West Germany's communist terrorist group, the Red Army Faction, but by the time she and Delaroche worked together, she had been stripped of her ideals and was in it only for the money. Delaroche had memorized every detail of the Chesapeake, the shoals, the rivers and bays, the flats and the headlands. All he required was a reading from his GPS unit to know exactly where he was in relation to land. He had passed Sandy Point, Cherry Point, and Windmill Point. By the time he reached Bluff Point, he had grown stiff and sore with the cold. He cut the engines and they drank hot coffee from a thermos flask. He checked the GPS navigation unit, 38.50 degrees latitude by 76.31 degrees longitude. He knew he was approaching Curtis Point, a headland at the mouth of the West River. His destination was the next tidal river feeding into the bay from Maryland, the South River, roughly 3 nautical miles to the north. As he passed Saunders Point, he saw the first light in the east, off the starboard side of the whaler. He rounded Turkey Point and felt the gentle nudge of the tide running out of the South River. Delaroche opened the throttle as he headed northeast up the river. He wanted to be ashore and on the road before dawn. He sped past Mayo Point and Brewer Point, Glebe Bay and Crab Creek. He passed beneath one bridge, then another. He came to a creek mouth and checked his navigation unit to make certain it was Broad Creek. The receding tide had left the creek shallower than the charts had promised. Twice Delaroche jumped into the frigid water and pushed the whaler off the bottom. Finally, he reached the head of the creek. He grounded the whaler in a patch of marsh grass, hopped overboard, and, pulling on the bow line, dragged the boat deep into the marsh. Rebecca clambered into the forward seating compartment and took hold of a large duffel filled with supplies, clothing, money, and electronic equipment. She handed the bag to Delaroche, then stepped over the side into the sodden marsh. The car was parked on a dirt track, exactly where the director had said it would be, a black Volvo station wagon, Quebec license plates. Delaroche had a key. He opened the trunk and tossed in the bag. He followed a series of 2-lane country roads for several miles, through farmland and sunlit pastures, until he came to Route 50. He turned onto the highway and headed east toward Washington. 1 hour after collecting the Volvo, they entered Washington on New York Avenue, a grimy commuter corridor stretching from the northeast section of the city to the Maryland suburbs. Delaroche had stopped once at a roadside gas station so he and Rebecca could change into proper clothing. He crossed the city on Massachusetts Avenue and pulled into the drive of the Embassy Row Hotel near DuPont Circle. There was a reservation waiting in the name of Mr. and Mrs. Claude Duras of Montreal. The demands of their cover story required Delaroche and Rebecca to share a single room. They slept until the late afternoon, Rebecca in the queen-size bed, Delaroche on the floor, with the bedspread as a mattress. He awoke suddenly at 4 p.m., startled by the surroundings, and realized he had been dreaming again of Maurice Leroux. He ordered coffee sent to the room, which he drank while he placed several items into a blue nylon backpack, 2 pieces of sophisticated electronic equipment, 2 cellular telephones, a flashlight, several small tools, and a Beretta 9mm. Rebecca emerged from the bathroom, dressed in blue jeans, tennis shoes, and a sweatshirt emblazoned with the words Washington, D.C., and an image of the White House. "How do I look?" she asked. "Your hair is too blonde." Delaroche reached in the duffel bag and tossed her a ball cap. "Put this on." Delaroche telephoned downstairs and asked the valet to have the Volvo waiting. He drove west along P Street. There was a tourist map on the dashboard that Delaroche did not bother to open. The streets of Washington, like the waters of the Chesapeake, were engraved in his memory. He crossed into Georgetown and drove along the quiet, tree-lined streets. It was considered the most glamorous neighborhood in Washington, with red brick sidewalks and large federal-style homes, but to Delaroche, whose eye was used to the canals and gabled houses of Amsterdam, it all seemed rather prosaic. He drove west on P Street until he reached Wisconsin Avenue. He headed south on Wisconsin, accompanied by the pounding beat of rap music vibrating from the gold BMW behind him. He turned onto N Street, and the madness of Wisconsin Avenue slowly dissipated behind them. The house was empty, just as Delaroche knew it would be. Ambassador Cannon was arriving from London the following afternoon. He was hosting a private dinner party for friends and family that evening. The next day he would take part in the conference on Northern Ireland at the White House, then attend a series of receptions in the evening, hosted by the parties to the talks. It was all in the director's dossier. Delaroche parked around the corner from the house on 33rd Street. He placed a camera around his neck and strolled the quiet block, Rebecca on his arm, pausing now and again to gaze at the large brick townhouses with light spilling from their windows. It was rather like Amsterdam, he thought, the way people kept their curtains open and allowed passers-by to gaze into their homes and assess their possessions. He had been there before. He knew the challenges that N Street posed to a man like him. There were no cafes in which to dawdle over coffee, no shops for diversionary purchases, no squares or parks to kill time without attracting attention. Just large, expensive homes with nosy neighbors and security systems. They walked past the Osborne's house. A black sedan was parked across the street. Seated behind the wheel was a man in a tan raincoat, reading the sports section of the Washington Post. So much for the director's theory that Ambassador Cannon would be easy to kill while he was in Washington, Delaroche thought. The man hadn't even set foot in town yet, and already the house was under watch. Delaroche paused a block away and made photographs of the home where John Kennedy had lived when he was a senator from Massachusetts. A number of cabinet secretaries lived in Georgetown. Their homes were under constant surveillance. If the official was involved in national security, such as the Secretary of State or the Defense Secretary, their bodyguards might even have a static post in a nearby apartment. But Delaroche felt confident that Douglas Cannon's security consisted entirely of the man in the tan raincoat. At least for now. He led Rebecca south on 31st Street for a half block, until they reached an alley that ran behind the Osborne's house. He peered into the half-darkness. Just as he suspected, it looked as if the back of the house was not under watch. Delaroche handed Rebecca a cellular telephone.
Stay here. Call me if there's trouble. If I'm not back in 5 minutes, leave and go back to the hotel. If you don't hear from me within a half hour, contact the director and request an extraction.
Rebecca nodded. Delaroche turned and set out down the alley. He paused behind the Osborne's house, then deftly scaled the fence and dropped into a well-tended garden surrounding a small swimming pool. He looked overhead and followed the lines leading from the telephone pole in the alley to the point where they attached to the house. He crossed the garden and knelt in front of the telephone switch box at the back of the house. He unzipped the backpack and removed his tools and a flashlight. Holding the flashlight between his teeth, he loosened the screws holding the cover of the switch box in place and studied the configuration of the lines for a moment. There were two lines leading into the house, but Delaroche only had the equipment to tap one of them. He suspected one line was probably reserved for telephone calls, the other for a fax machine or modem. He reached inside the backpack again and withdrew a small electronic device. Attached to the Osborne's telephone line, it would relay a high-frequency radio signal to Delaroche's cellular phone, allowing him to monitor the Osborne's telephone calls. It took Delaroche only 2 minutes to install the device on the Osborne's primary line and reattach the cover of the switch box. The second device would be much easier to install since it required only a window. It was a bugging mechanism that, when attached to the exterior of a window, would detect the vibration of sound waves inside a structure and convert them back into audio. Delaroche attached the sensor pad to the lower portion of a window off the main living room. It was concealed by a shrub outside and an end table inside. He buried the converter and transmitter unit in a patch of mulch in the garden. Delaroche retraced his steps across the lawn. He tossed the backpack over the fence, then scaled it and dropped down into the alley. The two units he had just placed on the Osborne's house had an effective range of 2 miles, which would allow him to monitor the Osborne's from the security of their hotel room at DuPont Circle. Rebecca was waiting for him at the end of the alley.
"Let's go," he said.
He took her by the hand and walked back to the Volvo. Delaroche sat in front of a receiver the size of a shoebox, testing the signal of the transmitter he had placed on the Osborne's window. Rebecca was in the bathroom. He could hear the sound of water running into the basin. She had been there for more than an hour. Finally, the water stopped running and she came out wearing a hotel bathrobe, her hair wrapped in a white towel like a shake. She lit one of his cigarettes and said,
"Does it work?"
"The transmitter is sending out a signal, but I won't be certain until there's someone in the house."
"I'm hungry," she said.
"Order some food from room service."
"I want to go out."
"It's better if we stay inside."
"I've been trapped on boats for 10 days. I want to go out."
"Get dressed and I'll take you out."
"Close your eyes," she said.
But Delaroche stood and turned to face her. He reached out and tugged at the towel around her head. Her hair was no longer an abrasive shade of blonde. It was nearly black and shimmering with dampness. Suddenly it was in sync with the rest of her features, her gray eyes, her luminous white skin, her oval face. He realized that she was a remarkably beautiful woman. Then he became angry. He wished he could hide in a bathroom with a bottle of elixir and emerge an hour later with his old face. She seemed to read his thoughts.
"You have scars," she said, tracing a finger along the bottom of his jawline. "What happened?"
"If you stay in this business too long, a face can become a liability."
Her finger had moved from his jawline to his cheekbone, and she was toying with the collagen implants just beneath the skin.
"What did you look like before?" she asked.
Delaroche raised his eyebrows and pondered her question for an instant. He thought, how would anyone describe his own appearance? If he said he had been beautiful once before Maurice LaRue destroyed his face, she might think he was a liar. He sat down at the desk and removed a piece of hotel stationery and a pencil.
"Go away for a few minutes," he said.
She went into the bathroom again, closed the door, and switched on the hairdryer. He worked quickly, the pencil scratching over the paper. When he finished, he appraised his own features rather dispassionately, as if they belonged to a creature of his imagination. He slipped the self-portrait beneath the bathroom door. The hairdryer stopped whining. Rebecca came out, holding Delaroche's old face in her hands. She looked at him, then at the image on the paper. She kissed the portrait and dropped it onto the floor. Then she kissed Delaroche.
Who was she, Jean-Paul?
Who?
The woman you were thinking about while you were making love to me.
I was thinking about you.
Not all the time. I'm not angry, Jean-Paul. It's not as if...
She stopped herself before she could finish her thought. Delaroche wondered what she might have said. She lay on her back, her head resting on his abdomen, her dark hair spread across his chest. Streetlights streamed through the open curtains and fell upon her long body. Her face was flushed and scratched from lovemaking, but the rest of her body was bone white in the lamplight. It was the skin of someone who had rarely seen the sun. Delaroche doubted she had ever set foot outside the British Isles before she'd been driven into hiding.
Was she beautiful? And don't lie to me anymore.
Yes, he said.
What was her name?
Her name was Astrid.
Astrid what?
Astrid Vogel.
I recall a woman named Astrid Vogel who belonged to the Red Army faction,
Rebecca said.
She left Germany and went into hiding after she murdered a German police official.
That was my Astrid, Delaroche said, tracing his finger along the edge of Rebecca's breast. But Astrid didn't kill the German policeman. I killed him. Astrid just paid the price.
So you're German?
Delaroche shook his head.
What are you, then? What's your real name?
But he ignored her question. His fingers moved from her breasts to the edge of her rib cage. Rebecca's abdomen reacted involuntarily to his touch, drawing in sharply. Delaroche stroked the white skin of her stomach and the tops of her thighs. Finally, she took his hand and placed it between her legs. Her eyes closed. A gust of wind moved the curtains, and her skin prickled with goosebumps. She tried to draw the bedspread over her body, but Delaroche pushed it away.
There were things in the houseboat in Amsterdam that belonged to a woman, she said softly, eyes closed. Astrid lived on that boat, didn't she?
Yes, she did.
Did you live there with her?
For a while.
Did you make love in the bed beneath the skylight?
Rebecca,
it's all right, she said. You won't hurt my feelings.
Yes, we did.
What happened to her?
She was killed.
When?
Last year.
Rebecca pushed away his hand and sat up. What happened?
We were working together on something here in America, and it turned out badly.
Who killed her?
Delaroche hesitated a moment. The whole thing had gone too far already. He knew he should shut it down, but for some reason he wanted to tell her more. Perhaps Vladimir was right. A man who sees ghosts can no longer behave like a professional. Michael Osborne, he said. Actually, his wife killed her.
Why?
Because we were sent here to kill Michael Osborne. He paused for a moment, his eyes flickering about her. Sometimes in this business things don't go as planned.
Why are you hired to kill Osborne?
Because he knew too much about one of the Society's operations.
What operation?
The downing of transatlantic flight 002 last year.
I thought it was shot down by that Arab group, the Sword of Gaza.
It was shot down at the behest of an American defense contractor named Mitchell Elliott. The Society made it appear as though the Sword of Gaza was involved, so Elliott's company could sell a missile defense system to the American government. Osborne suspected this, so I was hired by the director to eliminate everyone involved in the operation, as well as Osborne.
Who actually shot down the plane?
A Palestinian named Hassan Mahmoud.
How do you know?
Because I was there that night. Because I killed him when it was over. She drew away from him. Delaroche could see real fear on her face and feel the bed shaking gently with her trembling. She drew the blanket to her breast to hide her body from him. He stared at her, his face utterly expressionless.
"My God," she said, "you're a monster."
"Why'd you say that?"
"There were more than 200 innocent people on that plane."
"And what about the innocent people that your bombers killed in London and Dublin?"
"We didn't do it for money,"
she snarled. "You had a cause," he said contemptuously.
"That's right."
"A cause you believe is just."
"A cause I know is just," she said. "You'll kill anyone as long as the price is right."
"My God, you really are a stupid woman, aren't you?" She tried to slap him, but he caught her hand and held onto it, easily resisting her efforts to pull away. "Why do you think the society is willing to help you?" Delaroche said. "Because they believe in the sacred rights of Protestants in Northern Ireland? Of course not. Because they think it will advance their own interests. Because they think that it will make them money." "History has passed you by, Rebecca. The Protestants have had their day in Northern Ireland, and now it's over. No amount of bombing, no amount of killing is ever going to turn back the clock."
"If you believe that, why are you doing this?"
"I don't believe in anything. This is what I do. I've killed in the name of every failed cause in Europe. Yours is just the latest." He let go of her, and she drew away, rubbing her hand as if it had touched something evil, and, I hope, the last.
"I should have kept walking that day in Amsterdam."
"You're probably right. But now you're here, and you're stuck with me, and if you do precisely as I say, you might actually survive. You'll never see Northern Ireland again, but at least you'll be alive."
"Somehow I doubt that," she said. "You're going to kill me when this is all over, aren't you?"
"No, I'm not going to kill you."
"You probably killed Astrid Vogel, too."
"I didn't kill Astrid, and I'm not going to kill you." He pulled away the blanket and exposed her body to the light. He held out his hand to her, but she remained still. "Take my hand," Delaroche said. "I won't hurt you. I give you my word." Rebecca took his hand. He pulled her to him and kissed her mouth. She resisted for a moment. Then she surrendered, kissing him, clawing at his skin as if she were drowning in his arms. When she guided him into her body, she suddenly went very still, staring at Delaroche with an animal directness that unnerved him.
"I like your other face better," she said.
"So do I."
"When this is over, maybe we can go back to the doctor who did this, and he can make your face like it was before."
"I'm afraid that's not possible," he said. She seemed to understand exactly what he was saying.
"If you're not going to kill me," she said, "then why did you tell me your secrets?"
"I'm not sure."
"Who are you, Jean-Paul?"
36. Washington. The following morning, Michael and Elizabeth flew from New York to Washington, along with the children and Maggie. They separated at National Airport. Michael took a chauffeured government sedan to the White House to brief National Security Advisor William Bristol on Northern Ireland. Elizabeth, Maggie, and the children crowded into a car service Lincoln for the ride into Georgetown. Elizabeth had not been back to the large red-brick Federal on N Street in more than a year. She loved the old house, but climbing the curved brick steps, she was suddenly overwhelmed with bad memories. She thought of the long struggle with her own body to have children. She thought of the afternoon Astrid Vogel had come here to take her hostage so the assassin called October could murder her husband.
"Are you all right, Elizabeth?" Maggie asked.
Elizabeth wondered how long she had been standing there, key in hand, unable to unlock the door.
"Yes, I'm fine, Maggie. I was just thinking about something."
The alarm chirped as she pushed back the front door. She punched in the disarm code and it fell silent. Michael had turned the place into a fortress, but she would never feel completely safe here. She helped Maggie get the children settled, then carried her suitcase upstairs to the bedroom. She was unzipping the bag when the doorbell rang. She walked downstairs and peered through the peephole. Outside was a tall, brown-haired man in a blue suit and tan raincoat.
"Can I help you?"
she said, without opening the door. "My name is Brad Hayworth, Mrs. Osborne. I'm the Diplomatic Security Service agent assigned to watch your house."
Elizabeth opened the door.
"DSS? But my father doesn't arrive from London for another 6 hours."
"Actually, we've been watching the house for a couple of days now, Mrs. Osborne."
"Why?"
"After the incident in Britain, we decided it was probably best to err on the side of caution."
"Are you alone?"
"For now, but when the ambassador arrives, we'll add a second man to the detail."
"That's reassuring," she said. "Would you like to come inside?"
"No, thank you, Mrs. Osborne. I need to stay out here."
"Can I get you anything?"
"I'm fine," he said. "I just wanted to let you know that we're around."
"Thank you, Agent Hayworth." Elizabeth closed the door and watched as the DSS man walked down the front steps and got back in his car. She was glad he was there. She went upstairs and sat down at the desk in Michael's old study. She made a series of brief telephone calls, to Ridgewell's Catering, to the valet service, to her office in New York to check messages. Then she spent another hour returning calls. Maria, the cleaning lady, arrived at noon. Elizabeth dressed in a nylon tracksuit and went outside. She bounced down the front steps, waved to Brad Hayworth, and jogged down the brick sidewalk of N Street. At the Embassy Row Hotel, Delaroche had hung the Do Not Disturb sign outside the room and double-locked the door. For the past hour, he had been listening to Elizabeth Osborne, talking on the telephone, talking to her nanny and her children, talking to the DSS agent guarding the house. Delaroche now knew exactly when Douglas Cannon would arrive from London and when he would leave for the White House the next morning to attend the Northern Ireland conference. He also knew that the DSS agent parked in front of the house was named Brad Hayworth and that a second agent would join the detail after the ambassador's arrival. He heard the arrival of a cleaning woman called Maria, who spoke with a heavy Spanish accent, South American, Delaroche guessed, Peru or perhaps Bolivia. He heard Elizabeth Osborne announce that she was going for a run and would be back in an hour. He jumped as she slammed the front door on her way out. 5 minutes later, he was startled by a howling noise that sounded like the roar of a jet engine. It was so loud, Delaroche had to rip the headphones from his ears. For a moment, he feared some calamity had befallen the Osborne's house. Then he realized it was only Maria, running her vacuum near the window where Delaroche had planted his microphone.
This ends Disc 8.